Good morning. My name is June Guinan, and I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is July 13th, 1972. I am so delighted to be here. You know, I don't know about you, but sometimes back home you have a week where you really feel like you need a meeting. This was one of those weeks where I felt like I needed a convention. And I'm delighted to have been invited to be a part of your convention. And this has been an incredible one. You know, I sat with Ed at dinner last night, speaker yesterday, and we were talking about just how much is going on and how much is coming still. You know, I had arrived yesterday at 2 o'clock, and I thought I was early. And when I got here at 2, I found out I'd missed half the convention already, you know. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. It was funny when Debbie was just introducing me. She reminded me of something when she was talking about that I had a lot of years in the program. I went and talked at a meeting in Easter Sunday right near where I live. And, excuse me. And right after I finished talking, this guy came over and with a bunch of others. I had a feeling his sponsor had ordered him to thank the speaker. But anyway, he was standing in line and he came up and he shook my hand and he said, "That was a good story. You told it really well." He said, "I don't believe that was your story, but I like the way you told it." And I thought about that so many times since then, because I guarantee you, if that guy had seen me when I came in, he would have believed that it was my story. And it's nice to know that Alcoholics Anonymous has made changes in my life and in my appearance so that I no longer look like I had the story that I had when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like those of you who are new or might be visiting Alcoholics Anonymous or maybe at your first couple of conventions to know that I'm not paid to get up here and tell you my story. I'm not an expert or an authority on alcoholism or AA. I'm just another alcoholic, and I came here to tell you a little bit about my experience, strength, and hope. And, of course, when I'm done, I know a lot of you will think, thank God we didn't have to pay her for that. But I thought so much about the book and in the last couple of days as I've heard the the speakers that I have been fortunate enough to hear since I got here. And I thought about that line in the book where it says, "We will be amazed before we are halfway through." I have every reason to believe at this point in my life that I'm nowhere near halfway through, and I've got to tell you, I'm definitely amazed with Alcoholics Anonymous and with what it has accomplished in my life and in the lives of a lot of other people that I have known and some that I have just met since being here, you know, and listening to the people share. It's sort of funny. I mean, I got sober in Los Angeles, and I still live there, and I don't feel like I should be the one to tell Ed what is next coming this way. Those nude meetings left 9 months ago, L.A., so I don't want to... You'll just have to wait for the surprise that's coming. But, you know, we have lots of conventions and we have lots of meetings and we have lots of sober people and they're all different ages and they're all different backgrounds and they're all different, you know, people, and it's just wonderful. You know, and I get so excited about AA and where I got sober and all the speakers that I have heard that sometimes it's hard for me to believe. I mean, you sort of know that people are sober other places, but you don't really, you know, you sort of think that, well, I always meet them at my conventions in California, and you sort of think they got to come here to find out, you know, how AA is working. And it was just so great, you know, to hear Scotty last night, you know, and he was talking about how all the people from out of town, now that they knew how AA, you know, where the best AA was, they could take it back to their group and stuff like that, you know, and I was thinking, God, you know, that's sometimes how I feel, and I forget that there's a bunch of people, like right here in Texas, they're sober, they're doing exactly the same things that we were doing and are doing, and their sponsors are telling them exactly the same rude, inconsiderate remarks as my sponsors told me. The only difference between your sobriety and California, as far as I can see, is that you guys talk funny. And other than that, we're all saying and doing exactly the same things. And it's just so incredible. You know, when I got sober, I'll tell you, I grew up in a little town called Venice, which is right on the beach in Los Angeles. And I had run away a couple of times, and I made it 6 miles east to a town called Culver City. And that's the farthest I had ever been when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And for me to be all the way across the country down here, you know, with a bunch of people, most of whom I've never met before in my life, it's just incredible. You know, things like that just don't happen. I am one of those people that happen to believe I was born an alcoholic. And I don't really want to have any, excuse me, philosophical discussions with anyone about whether that's the case or not, but it's just what I happen to believe. And I believe that because there was something wrong with me before I ever began to drink. And the way that first manifested itself in me was at the age of 5 years old, I became obsessed with the idea of suicide. And at that time, at five, I began to take overdoses of baby aspirin, and I began to cut my hands and fingers and wrists with razor blades on a regular basis. And I just realized that my watch is broken. Do you have to use your watch?
No.
Thanks. thank you. When I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, it had taken, I had known about this program for a while before I ever came in. But I'd wanted absolutely no part of it. My desire to kill myself was something that was with me every single day before I ever came into this program. I can honestly tell you that there wasn't one day in my life before I got sober that I didn't try to take my own life, put myself in a position where someone else would take my life, or pray to a God that I was slowly losing faith in to please take my life and let me out of here. Now, I know that there's not a lot of people in or outside of Alcoholics Anonymous that began to seriously want to kill themselves at the age of 5 years old. I know that, you know, shortly after that period of time, I was taken to a psychiatrist and to see what was wrong with me. I have been to a number of psychiatrists before coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, but I've never told them anything. I always felt they should work for their money. And they never got anything out of me. But I did go to see psychiatrists and things like that. But, you know, it's interesting because in being sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, I've been able to find explanations that seem to be able to tell me a little bit about my behavior when I was growing up. I grew up in an alcoholic home. I grew up with an alcoholic mother, and I was the only child, and I never had a father. The only men in my life were the drunken men that my mother ran around with, and there was a lot of violence in my home. There were a lot of broken promises. There were a lot of things that go on in every alcoholic home that any of you or know or have been a part of. And so I knew all about this disease and all about the things that were going on. But as I grew up in Venice at that time, I was sort of an observer of people, and I was a rather quick child. I noticed that there were men and women. And I noticed that although everybody that I knew at this time in my life were alcoholics, they all drank and they all did the same sorts of things, there were some very big differences between men and women. In fact, in my life before coming into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I can't recall on one occasion ever seeing a man cry. In fact, the only emotion I ever remember seeing men have was anger and rage. That meant to me that that's all men ever felt, that you couldn't hurt them, that you couldn't break their heart, that you could never make them cry, whether you walked out of their life or whether you stayed. I thought the only reaction you could get out of a man was maybe if he cared about you and you got him upset enough, he'd punch you in the face. But that was really about it as far as their feelings went. On the other hand, although a lot of the women in my life reacted with violence and rage too, I knew that they could be hurt. I saw them cry. I saw things hurt them. I even saw a couple of them have nervous breakdowns from the amount of emotional pain that they were in. I looked at two different groups of people, and I decided immediately which one I wanted to be like. And I spent my life before coming into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous trying to emulate what I thought a man was. And that to me was someone who cared about no one, who felt absolutely nothing. And if I or they happen to feel anything, you never let anyone know it. Now, the funny thing is that with this desire that I had to be this kind of person, I seemed to be the kind of person that was absolutely impossible to be, because I seemed to be the person that had absolutely no insulation for my emotions whatsoever. When I first went out in the world at 5 and 6 years old and had to go to school with a bunch of strangers that I didn't know, they teased me about having curly hair and being skinny and being tall and all the different things that kids tease everybody else about too, you know. But when they teased me, I remember how much it hurt. I can remember it today. It felt like somebody was cutting me with a knife inside. And these were people I didn't even know or care about, and they had the ability to hurt me in that way. And so I learned something about myself right off. I learned right away at 5 and 6 years old that I was the kind of person that I hated the most in the entire world. I was weak. I couldn't control my emotions. And that for me became my obsession. Was the ability to control my emotions and to just not care and not feel anything at all. I was fortunate enough to be introduced to drugs when I was 7 years old, and I began to drink alcoholically a year later when I was 8. By the time I was 9, I found a combination that was to work for me. That was barbiturates, and or sleeping pills or downers or whatever you might know them as, and alcohol. And I very rarely used one of those without the other, because the combined effect of those got me where I wanted to go. And I wasn't a party girl. I was never a social drinker. I was out there drinking for one thing and one thing only. I wanted complete oblivion. I didn't want to feel good. I wanted to feel absolutely nothing at all. And that's how and why I drank. And I'm sure knowing that now, you'll understand why I don't have any funny stories to tell you, because when you're drinking that way and taking those kind of chemicals, you can't do much. And I didn't. When I was growing up, they said to me, hey, June, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I told them, a boy. And they told me that I couldn't, because it wasn't as easy back then as it is today. But that is what I wanted. And when I found that out, I was very disappointed, and so I had to settle for the next best thing. To me, there was only one alternative if I could not be a boy, and that alternative was very simple. It was to be a tough broad. And I spent all my time before coming to Alcoholics Anonymous trying to be a tough broad. And, you know, I suppose depending on where you live, being a tough broad means all different kinds of things. I lived in Venice, and it's a beach town. And so one of the things that involved being a tough broad was that you never wore shoes. You had to have tough feet. And that was very important to me. And I ran with a gang, because you have to be in a gang, or at least I thought you had to be in a gang if you're going to be a tough broad. And I did a lot of fighting. I want everyone here to know today that I have never won a fight in my life. But I also want you to know that I never fought less than five people at a time. And I found out after I came into Alcoholics Anonymous that the reason I was so willing to spend all those years that I was out there walking around with a black eye and a swollen lip and a puffed up face was because I thought that was tough. I thought if you could hang in there and let five people pound you in the face, you were one tough broad, you know. And that's what I thought other people would think, and so I did it. And I did a lot of things to prove to other people that I was tough. One of the things I used to do is I'd stand there with my gang, and people would notice us. We were sort of odd-looking. And they'd kind of point and whisper to one another, and so I would take my cigarette, and I would throw it down, and I would put it out with my bare feet. And then these people would poke and whisper back and forth, and of course I knew what they were saying. It was entirely clear to me. They were saying to one another, wow, that is one tough broad. And of course, my sponsor convinced me that after I got sober, that perhaps what some of them were saying to one another was, did you see that? That person just put flesh to fire. Why would anyone do anything so stupid, you know? But I thought that it was very tough, and I was sure that everyone else would think that it was tough, and so I did it regularly. Now, simply stepping on a lit cigarette butt with your bare feet does not really mean that you have achieved toughness. You still have one more step. That is the ability to thereafter walk upon those feet as if it does not hurt. And when you can do that, then you have really made it as being tough. Those were the kind of activities that kept up large parts of my days when I was out there drinking. I've always been happy that tattoos weren't popular when I was on the street. About maybe 3 or 5 years ago, it seems like tattoos became really popular for women, at least out in L.A., and some of the women in the program and outside the program got little tattoos, you know, and they got things like butterflies and flowers, you know, and panda bears and all kinds of cute little things, you know, but if tattoos had been popular when I was on the streets, I'd be standing up here today, and I'd have a shark on my arm, and it would swim whenever I did this. Gotten something, you know, like a battleship on my chest, or maybe a canoe in my case, but if I thought that wasn't that funny, if I thought that it was tough, I would have done it. I was brought to Alcoholics Anonymous by my mother. I was not brought here because I'd asked for help, certainly, or because I wanted help. I was brought here because my mother was afraid that if she left me alone in the apartment, I'd get her evicted from another apartment. And so she made me go to the meeting with her that night. And as I walked in the doors of that meeting that night, the miracle of this program began to happen for me, even though that wasn't the day that I got sober. And the reason for that was because there was a guy in that meeting that I admired more than anybody else in the entire world. And I admired Paul for a lot of reasons. Some of them I know some of you aren't going to understand, but I'm going to tell you them anyway. I admired Paul because he'd been in prison, because he rode a motorcycle, Because he carried a knife and had it with him that night at the meeting? Because he was extremely hostile and violent and everyone in my neighborhood was afraid of him. And I looked at this guy and I thought, you know, he is everything I have ever wanted to be. And I just thought, I never thought anybody that great would come to AA. And he really was, you know. What I really wanted was the ability to walk into rooms full of people when I was out there on the streets, and I wanted everyone there to back away from me in terror. Now, when you're 87 pounds, that almost never happens. But when you were someone like Paul, it did happen. He had achieved the ultimate in my eyes, and here he was sitting in an AA meeting, and it really made an impact on me. Of course, I got drunk the next night, but it really did matter, and it was something that impressed me. And after I got drunk that night, I came back to meetings. Spent a lot of time following Paul around. He was brand new in the program. He was going to lots of meetings, so I went to lots of meetings. And I spent the time in between the meetings. I didn't raise my hand, but I spent the time in between the meetings trying to convince Paul that I wasn't an alcoholic. I explained to him that I was too young to be an alcoholic, that I had my whole life ahead of me, that my mother was really an alcoholic, that I wasn't anything like my mother. And that I just really wasn't an alcoholic. And I later found out that non-alcoholics don't have to spend any time convincing people that they're not alcoholics. Finally, Paul turned to me and he said, you know, Gene, I'm sort of new in this program, and they tell me that I can't diagnose anybody's disease but my own. He said, but in your case, I'm going to make an exception. He said, I've seen the way that you drink. And I happen to believe that if you don't come into this program and take what these people have to offer you, within a period of 6 months or less, you're going to be out on the streets, you're going to be shooting stuff, and you're going to be selling your ass. And I knew he wasn't trying to scare me. He wasn't like some teacher in school that was trying to make up some story so that she could scare some of the kids in her class. He was just standing up there, and he was talking about things that had happened in his life, things that had happened that were beginning to happen in mine. And I thought a little bit about what he said, and I did not want to be an alcoholic. I didn't want anything to do with an organization that would allow my mother to be a part of it. And I was absolutely nothing like my mother. And I just didn't feel like I needed this program. And during that 2-week period of time, absolutely every alternative but Alcoholics Anonymous was removed from my life. I had been living with my mother at that time for a very brief period of time. And outside of myself, there wasn't anyone in the world that I hated more than my mom. And during that period of time that I was living with her, I had never been able to control the anger and the rage that I felt for her. And we had always had a very volatile relationship. And during that time, I attacked her, and she did not feel in sobriety. She had to submit to my attacks any longer, and she asked me to leave her home, and I did. My family hadn't spoken to me in 3 years, and I was not allowed to call or come by under any circumstances whatsoever, and I didn't even try. I had been in 5, or I think actually 6 foster homes up to that point. I had been thrown out of all of them, and none of them would take me back. I tried to get into some of the alcohol recovery and drug recovery homes in the Los Angeles area at that time, and none of them would take me, some because of my age and some just because of my attitude. I thought to myself, well, you know what? Who needs all this family stuff and all that? Because I got the most important thing. I got the only thing that any tough broad needs. I got my gang. And then one day as I walked down an alley, all 5 members of my own gang beat me up. And so I found myself sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was 87 pounds, and I had a black eye, and I had a swollen lip, and I didn't have any family, and I didn't have any friends, and I didn't have any money, and I didn't have any place to live, and I didn't have any food, and I didn't have any shoes. Wouldn't have worn them at that time, even if I had, though. And I started to raise my hand in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. At that time, there were some people in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous who I don't think were aware of the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous, in particular the 3rd tradition, the one that says the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. And I suppose to someone like me, and maybe to all of us, really, that's probably the greatest thing that Alcoholics Anonymous ever did, was to have that tradition. But anyway, at that time, the reason I think they didn't know that was because people came up to me after meetings when I started to raise my hand, and they told me I was too young to be an alcoholic. And they didn't want a little kid sitting in their meetings while they were talking about serious things. And I understood that. I'd been thrown out of every place I'd been up to that point. I hadn't been to as many places as an awful lot of other people in Alcoholics Anonymous had been. But by the time I was sitting in that room in Alcoholics Anonymous, I had no place left to go. And so I only had one answer left, the same answer I've been trying to use since I was 5 years old. I went over to a friend of my mother's house. I went into her bathroom, which was the first place I went at anybody's house I ever visited, and I found the kind of pills that I needed, and I took an overdose. And before I passed out that day, I went to a noon meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went into the meeting, and I was unable to stand or walk by the time I got there, and so I had to lay down. And I don't know about where you got sober, but in West Los Angeles, where I got sober, we almost never call on people to participate who are laying in the meeting. But for some reason that day, they called on me, and I certainly can't tell you what I said, but they were able to discern that I had taken something I shouldn't have, and the next thing I recall was waking up in a hospital and having a doctor explain to me that the pills I had taken were to slow down my heart. And had I been there 5 or 10 minutes later, I would have been in a coma that they probably couldn't have brought me out of. Now, I don't know exactly why that overdose was any different than any of the others that I've been inflicting upon myself over the years that I was out there drinking. But I know that it was. Just since that time, I haven't taken anything that affects me from the neck up, and that's how I personally define sobriety. And as I've already told you, if I continue to do that one day at a time, I'll celebrate 13 years, the 13th of July of this year. I know what I was trying to say to those people that day in that meeting. I think really what I was trying to say to them is, you know what, I don't know if I've gone as far as some of you people have. And then again, maybe I've gone a little bit farther than some of you. But I don't really think that's the point here. Because the point is, I don't have any place left to go. And I don't know if I want what you people have. I don't even know what you have. All I know is I can't stand what I've got anymore. And you don't have to tell me if I go back out there on the streets I'm going to die. Because dying doesn't scare me. Dying is what I have been trying to do since I was 5 years old. What scares me is maybe I can go out there and live for another 20 or 30 years like some of you people have, and that's what I can't stand. I can't stand living out there that way anymore. So please let me stay. And the people of Alcoholics Anonymous have let me stay. And in large part, it's because we had a tradition, that third one. I want to read you something because obviously that tradition became extremely important to me. But it really is so important to all of us. And I want to read you a little part in 12 and 12. Where it talked about what they were going to do when they were talking about, you know, traditions and whether they needed any or not. We were resolved to admit nobody to AA but that hypothetical class of people we termed pure alcoholics. Except for their guzzling and the unfortunate results thereof, they could have no other complications. So, beggars, tramps, asylum inmates, prisoners, queers, plain crackpots, and fallen women were definitely out. Yes, sir, we cater only to pure and respectable alcoholics. Now, I don't know about you, but if they had those requirements in Alcoholics Anonymous, neither I, my sponsors, or any of my closest friends would be members today. And I'm awfully grateful that they decided to just throw all that stuff out and make it. You only have to have a desire to stop drinking, and nobody can ever throw you out of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm glad I wasn't on the committee for making traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous, because when I got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was one of the worst snobs you have ever seen, and it took a long time for me to get over it. When I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was from Venice, I had been poor, and I was a tough fraud, and if you didn't fit into some of those categories, I wouldn't let you in AA. I didn't like you if you had money. I didn't like you if you were married. I didn't like you if you'd had a mother and a father. I didn't like you if you had a car. There were a lot of things that I didn't like. Now, I got to tell you, when I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I had a bad attitude. I don't want you to think I got a bad attitude when I came in, because that wouldn't be true. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous with the same attitude I'd had all my life, and it was a bad one. When I got into this program, I didn't like women. I didn't like any women. I didn't like my mother, I didn't like me, and I didn't like any of the other women in Alcoholics Anonymous. I wanted nothing to do with them. I didn't like it when they spoke in meetings, and I tried not to listen, because I didn't want to be a woman, and I didn't want to relate to women. It's actually something that always makes me feel better when I have to talk to a big group of people, because I know there's got to be some tough broads out there who don't want to hear what anybody in a little white lacy thing has to say. And I know there's also got to be some tough guys out there who think there isn't a woman anywhere that could say anything that they could relate to. So I know there's never as many people listening to me as it looks like. But when when I was new. I didn't like women. And as far as the men in Alcoholics Anonymous, the only men I'd ever known in my life were alcoholics. And all they ever did was beat up women. So alcoholic men scared me. And the men in Alcoholics Anonymous scared me, too. And I don't know about where you got sober, but when I got sober, all they had in AA was men and women. And I didn't like any of them. So I started out right away with a problem. It's funny to me because when I tell you, the way that I arrived in Alcoholics Anonymous, with absolutely nowhere to go, no place to sleep at night, except for outside, no money, no food, no clothes, you know, you really think that somebody like that, I would think just today, you know, if it wasn't myself, I just couldn't believe it, but I would think that someone like that would come into this program and be so grateful for the love and the kindness that some of the people here offered. But that was not the case with me. I didn't want any part of the love or the kindness that was offered in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't want anyone to touch me, and I'd like to assure you that for several months, they did not. I came into this program, and I brought my motorcycle jacket that said on the back of it, "Do unto others, and then split." I continued to wear my motorcycle chains after I got sober, and I had this black eye for a long time after I got sober. And I smoked 3 packs of cigarettes a day when I got to this program. I increased my smoking after I got sober. And nobody ever lit one of those cigarettes. Occasionally someone would hold a match, and I'd allow them to hold it as long as they wished. But they did not light my cigarette with it. Sometimes somebody would hold a door open for me, and I'd allow them to hold it until their arm got tired, and when the door closed, I would open it for myself, and I would walk in. I didn't accept rides to meetings or ask for them. I didn't want anyone anywhere in Alcoholics Anonymous to think that I needed anyone. I wanted you to know I was just fine all by myself. I mean, that's really funny, because if I'd been doing all that well by myself, I never would have come to Alcoholics Anonymous. But it seemed very important to me. After I got sober, I noticed that the people around here were very close to one another. There were a lot of hugging, a lot of kissing, and a lot of close emotional relationships that were developing in meetings around me. And so I had to think fast to make sure I could avoid that. And so I took up smoking cigars and a pipe. And I don't mean those little cigars that sometimes ladies smoke. I mean big cigars and big pipes. And I noticed that many people found this extremely offensive. When I got to this program, I also had an extremely limited vocabulary. It consisted almost solely of profanity, with the exception of a few other words like the and mother. And that was really it. Now, I had spent my life out there trying to have the ability to tear people apart verbally. Because when you're 87 pounds, you don't do it any other way. And so, for me, when I got to this program, I had one form of communication only. And that was the ability to insult and put down and tear people apart. The closest thing to a compliment I ever gave in my life before I came into this program was, "That was a good fight." And other than that, nothing nice ever came out of my mouth about you or about me. And that's the way that I arrived in Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I got here and I noticed that people were starting to try and get close to one another and I wanted to avoid that, I made sure to use this profanity and use my verbal attacks as much as possible on people, thinking, of course, that I was extremely good at it, not realizing, of course, that it was something like a goldfish coming into a pond full of sharks when you try and verbally attack a bunch of people in Alcoholics Anonymous. So what I'd like you to know is that if you managed to act in that manner, as I did, there could be times when you could sit in a meeting this size and have an entire row all to yourself. I was fortunate enough to find a couple of sponsors in Alcoholics Anonymous. A guy became my sponsor, and he was Jeff was someone who had been from a similar background that I had, and he knew about hostility from personal experience, and he knew about dealing with someone like me. And when Jeff thought I was getting out of hand, either being too rude, using too much profanity, or whatever it might be, he would grab me around the neck and he would threaten to kill me. Now, I have read the big book over and over, and in that chapter, Working with Others, I have never seen the part where it says you should reach around their neck and threaten to kill them. But it always managed to get my attention. Now, the funniest thing, too, though, is that I found another sponsor. And this is an interesting thing because this sponsor was a woman, and I told you how I felt about them. Now, Dale became my sponsor for one reason only. I went to 21 meetings a week when I got sober that first year in Alcoholics Anonymous, and almost the first two. And it seemed to me, as I went to these 21 meetings a week, that a woman named Gail Wilson spoke at 18 of those meetings every week. I just couldn't get away from her. So I thought to myself, maybe if I ask her to be my sponsor, I can find out where she's speaking, and then I won't have to go to that meeting and hear her so often. And that's how Gail became my sponsor. And Gail and I were very different. Very different. We were definitely what they were talking about in the book when it says we were people who normally would not mix. Gail was from the South. She had a mother and a father. I tried not to hold it against her, but she had. And she was really a lot more of the lady variety, which was the type of woman that I particularly disliked. But anyway, not only did Gail not use the same kind of language that I did, she didn't know what most of the words I was using meant. And we would go to meetings separately, because as I've told you, I did not accept or ask for rides. And I would get to the meeting, and Gail would see me, and she would come up to me, and she would say, "Don't sit next to me at the meeting. I can't take the cigar smoke." And she said, "And not only that, please don't tell anyone that I am your sponsor." And that was fine with me, because I didn't want anybody to know that a tough broad like me had that kind of a person for a sponsor. So Gail and I would meet secretly after meetings and talk about the program. When I came into the program, one of the things that they used to say at my home group, the Monday Night Venice group, they would stand up and they'd say, "Now, if you're new, you got to get the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the most important thing that you can do. And if you don't have enough money to buy that book, neither did most of us. We sell that book for exactly what we pay for it, but we want you to take that book home. And if you don't have that kind of money, we're going to give it to you for nothing down and nothing a week." And then they'd throw in at my group, not any of the other groups hardly, but they'd say, "And if you don't want to talk to anybody, or you're too afraid to talk to somebody, you just steal it." And I had been stealing longer than I had been drinking. And I didn't see any reason to stop stealing just because I was stopping drinking. They were completely separate activities. And so I thought about this for a while, but I've always been a little superstitious, and I thought, you know, if I steal a big book from an AA meeting, it could jinx my sobriety. And so what I did instead was I decided to go to the library in Santa Monica, and while I was there, I stole the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And on my way out, I stole a copy of the 12 and 12 because I didn't see any reason to make two trips. And I never felt bad about that. You know, stealing had been a way of life for me for so long. The library had lots of books, and I had been told I had to have that book, and there just wasn't any other way to get it. I remember I called Jeff up that night, and we were talking about this about a year ago now. When I gave Jeff his 15-year cake, and I was telling him, I go, "You know, Jeff, I remember that day when I called you up and I told you I had stolen the big book. You didn't say to me, 'You know, kid, we no longer steal now that we're in Alcoholics Anonymous.'" I remember that isn't what he said. He said, "That's great, you got the book." Because he knew with someone like me, we had to start by getting the book. I became very active in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that was because both of my sponsors were very active. I went to lots and lots of meetings. They made me greeter at one of the meetings that I was at. And I would stand there with my motorcycle jacket and jeans and cigar, greeting the newcomers as they walked in. And I would hear their sponsors whisper to them as they walked by, "You see, if you keep drinking, you can end up like that." When I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, I was 13 years old. And what everybody likes to do was, after I got a little less hostile, drag me around and say, "Guess how old she is?" And they were guessing in the 37 range when I first came in. When I tell you that people thought that I was too young, I don't mean to tell you that as soon as I got sober, everybody accepted me completely as being an alcoholic. There were still a lot of people who had their doubts, and that's fine. There were still people who came up to me at meetings and they said, "You know, kid, I spilled more booze on my tie than you ever drank." And of course, I turned and explained to them that maybe if they hadn't spilled so much, they would have gotten sober younger. I had dropped out of seventh grade, and I refused to go back to school after I got sober, although my sponsors thought that it might be a good idea, but they didn't allow cigar or pipe smoking there, and so I wasn't going to go. And I was really completely unable to deal with people at that point. I've already told you my behavior in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was really the only place that I was tolerated, was in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I choose the word tolerate because love really wasn't appropriate for a long time in my particular case. But I'm extremely grateful for those people who tolerated me when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and allowed my behavior, my rude, obnoxious manners and all of those kind of things and didn't throw me out. Anyway, I went to lots and lots of meetings and I got very active in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got very active in my group. But there were still some things that I had trouble with within myself. When I had been out there on the street, I had been very proud of my behavior with respect to any time I'd been able to take advantage of anyone. I was the type of thief that made it a point to steal from everyone who ever trusted me. And when I was a kid and I was living in this alcoholic home, there were a lot of people who felt sorry for me and who would take me into their home and try and welcome me and make me a part of their home. And I would laugh behind their back and I would steal behind their back until they caught me and asked me to leave their home. And to me, I just felt those people were fools. And I thought I was great. I was a great thief. I was a great manipulator. And I got my way as far as moving things around just the way that I wanted it. And of course, all of this was one person's fault. We all knew that. It was my mother's fault. She was an alcoholic. In fact, the first time that I spoke at my home group, they didn't allow people to talk until you had 6 months. When I was 6 months, they let me talk, and I didn't let me talk after that for a year and a half. Because they said if they'd wanted to hear my mother's story, they would have invited her. And I got to tell you, before I forget, because sometimes I get caught up in my own story, that my mother is a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous today, and in December, I believe the 5th of this year, she'll celebrate 8 continuous years of sobriety. But anyway, when I was new in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I had a lot of problems still with the way that I felt about myself. Doris talked about vows and stuff like that. I didn't know much about that sort of thing. I can't remember in my life anybody ever telling me how often you're supposed to take a bath or when you're supposed to wash your hair or brush your teeth or anything like that. It just wasn't something, I remember standing out on the streets of Venice saying, do you use Gleam or Colgate? It wasn't part of my conversation with folks. And so when I got sober, I didn't know any of that stuff. And it was real hard for me, finding out those kind of things because it's sort of embarrassing to ask because you sort of feel everybody else just knows that sort of stuff. But more importantly than that, even when I started finding out about taking baths and showers and stuff like that, I didn't like to do it. Because when I got into the bathroom and I had to wash myself off, I just felt like throwing up. Because after I got sober, I became completely aware of who I was and where I had come from. I was a dirty little Venice broad. I'd never been anything but a dirty little Venice broad, and that's all I was ever going to be. Alcoholics Anonymous wasn't going to change where I came from. Alcoholics Anonymous was never going to be able to change any of the things that I had done out there, any of the people that I had taken advantage of or beaten up when they were helpless or anything else. They just couldn't change that, And I became completely aware of the kind of person that I was, and I just wasn't happy. Now, I want you to know, I was, as I've already told you, when I started to try and kill myself at 5 years old, I wasn't happy then either. In fact, I'm the kind of person that was never happy. I never liked me. I never liked being me. I never liked looking like me. And most of all, I never liked feeling like me. And when I got sober and I lost those chemicals that had made it okay for me not to feel anything at all, I had to start dealing with all those feelings all over again, and it was very hard for me. And that had a lot to do with the way that I acted in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, why I didn't want people to hug me or sit next to me. Because I thought that if they found out what I was like, and I knew they would if they got to know me, that they'd want to throw up and not like me either. And so I thought the best thing to do was to just pretend like I didn't like them and be very honest about the fact that I didn't like me and just see if I could keep everybody away. But I went to lots of meetings. And I sat in the meetings and I heard people get up here and share. And they talked about the fact that they had hated themselves too. And that today they were able to go out there, and all of them had different lengths of sobriety. It had happened for all of them at different times. But today they were able to go out there in the world and they could look other people right in the eye. And I just thought, well, that's not going to happen for someone like me. Because they haven't been where I have been. They didn't come from Venice. They didn't do the things that I did. But I'd sit there in those meetings and I thought, maybe if I go to lots of these meetings and I try and do this stuff, maybe someday I won't want to throw up when I look in the mirror. And that's why I kept coming to meetings. I had that much hope. Not that I'd ever liked me, but that maybe someday I wouldn't feel like throwing up over who I was and where I had been. And I went to lots of meetings based on that hope. When I was almost 11 months sober, or maybe even a little longer, I got invited to go to this convention with my home group. You know, where a bunch of people pile in the car and drive 8 hours. And we went to the International Young People's Conference in San Francisco. And this conference was held at a hotel called the St. Francis Hotel. And I don't know if any of you have ever been there. I haven't been back, so I can't tell you. I'm going to tell you the way I remember it, and I don't know whether it's accurate or not. We drove up to that place, and I already told you I had run away once 6 miles to Culver City. So I had never been, I had never been 400 miles from Venice before. And we pulled up at this hotel, and it was the most incredible place I had ever seen. It just looked like a castle to me. There were long red velvet drapes, and there was this beautiful thick carpet. And inside, there were women wearing long dresses and men wearing suits, and it was daytime. And then somebody came over, they opened the doors, and they were going to park the car. You know, now my mom and I lived in a lot of motels when I was growing up, but they never looked like this. And I had never been in a place like that or even seen a place like that in person. And everybody piled out of the car to race into the convention, and I wouldn't get out of the car. And my friends came out, and they go, come on, we got to go into the convention. And I got to go into the convention, and I said, I can't go in a place like that. I'm going to walk in that door, and they're going to come up, and they're going to say, excuse me, you're from Venice, and we don't want people like you in here. We want you to leave. And I knew that they would do that, and I didn't want to embarrass my friends. But I knew that I wasn't good enough to walk in a place like that. And they finally talked me into going in there a couple hours later. And I went in, and I went up to the room where we were all going to share. It's the only convention of Alcoholics Anonymous I've ever attended where I didn't go to one meeting. I wouldn't leave that room because I knew I was going to get thrown out of that place, you know. And I just didn't feel good enough to be there. I just thought that somebody that was a dirty little Venice fraud couldn't have nice things like that or be in a nice place like that. The interesting thing is, maybe about 3 weeks ago now, I went to this convention in Reno, and when I got there, they told me that the room that they booked for me had been given to somebody else, and they were going to have to bump me up to a suite, and I wasn't the least bit embarrassed. I thought, that'll be fine. So perfectly comfortable. I thought they should have given me a suite anyway. I'm just kidding. Anyway, those feelings I had about myself really did take a long time getting over. When I got sober, I got a job because, as I said, I refused to go to school. I got a perfect job for me because it allowed me to work very flexible hours and get to lots and lots of meetings with Alcoholics Anonymous, which is what I needed. And so sometimes I worked graveyard shifts, sometimes I worked split shifts, whatever it was. I was going to lots and lots of meetings, but I hated the job. And I started to learn a little bit from me right then and there what kind of jobs I was going to be able to get with my seventh grade education. I kept working anyway, and I ended up getting a chance. My sponsor heard about this program where I could go to school and learn how to be a secretary. Now, I'm going to tell you, when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, if there was anything in my life I never wanted to be, it was a secretary. But my sponsor thought I should try this program, and so I did. I went to this program, and I took all their little classes to be a secretary. I did pretty good and everything, but I had a little trouble with typing. I started out typing 17 words a minute with 9 errors. And I stayed in that school, and I typed one day at a time for 14 months. And at the end of that time, I was typing 37 words a minute with 19 errors, and they told me that I wasn't a secretary. And I said, I could have told them that 14 months ago, you know. But when I went out of there, they told me that I had to go ahead and, before I could try and get a job in any kind of office, I was going to need some kind of high school diploma. And they told me that there's a test that I could take. So I went over there, and I tried to take this test to get a high school diploma. And I did okay on the first 4 parts, but the 5th part was math. And I had the only math I'd ever had in my life was addition and subtraction and a little bit of multiplication and division. And they started out on this test with algebra. And then they started doing things like they had little boxes and triangles and stuff, and they wanted to know how many feet were in there. And I'd just never seen anything like that. You know, I started drawing pictures of feet in there. I didn't know what they were talking about. And I looked at the answer sheet, and all the answers were A, B, C, or D. So I turned to my higher power, and I said, look, God, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I have no idea about this stuff, so what I'm going to do is pick lots of A's, you know, for AA. And I hope you know your math. And I think everybody here should know that God's as bad at math as he is at typing. But we still managed to pass the test. And now it was time for me to go out and look for a job. And that, too, was probably one of the hardest things I ever had to do. First of all, I didn't know how to dress. You know, a couple women on the program took me out, and they gave me a couple things that they had and helped me buy a couple things so I could dress, you know, like you need to dress when you work in an office. And nobody I'd known worked in an office. My mom worked in a bar all the time, and I didn't know how, you dress or talk to people. And so they put these clothes on me, and it was sort of like Halloween. You know, here's a dirty little Venice bride dressing up like a citizen. And I thought it looked like a costume, too. But my sponsor said I had to do the footwork, and I went out there and I did the footwork. I went to lots and lots and lots of places, and I finally got a job. I was so excited. It was in an insurance company. It was terribly square. And I was very excited. And on the seventh day, they called me in the office, and by then I thought they were going to give me a raise. And they fired me. Said, I'm sorry, you don't have enough experience. And she said, and not only that, but you don't seem to have any common sense whatsoever. Now, I didn't even know what that was, but I knew I was being insulted, and I knew I was being fired. I went downstairs, and I immediately called our Los Angeles Central office. I said, my name's June. I'm a member. I've just been fired. What are you going to do about it? And they just laughed. I mean, I thought we'd pick it or something. Somebody sober in AA getting fired. Everybody gets fired when they're drinking, but I didn't think we'd allow them to do that to our members when they were sober. And I told my sponsor that night, I said, you know, I never got fired before I came to AA. And he reminded me I'd never had a job. Anyway, then I went out there and I started looking for another job. And one day I found myself filling out an application in a bank, which is sort of funny because I'd never even been in a bank at that point in my life, but I went ahead and I was filling out the application. Then it says at one point in the application, it says, now, as a bank employee, it's necessary that you be bonded, so we're going to do a thorough background check. And I thought, oh, no, not me. I mean, they call one library, and I've had it, you know. And but then I thought, I got to do the footwork, so I turned in the application, and I got called back on a series of interviews, and I got hired to work in a bank. I just couldn't believe it. Not only in a bank, they put me to work in the vault. And I didn't even know if AA could work that good. But it did. I didn't take anything the whole time I was there. And while I was there, I started to go to school. And up until that point, I had really been unable to read. When I used to stand at the door greeting people when I was new, somebody would walk up and say, hi, I'm Kathy, and I'd say, hi, I'm June. And somebody else would walk up and say, hi, I'm Mary, and I'd say, hi, I'm Kathy. Because all I could remember was the last thing I'd heard, you know. And I would go home after meeting, and I would try and read the big book, and I would read the same sentence over and over and over, and I just couldn't put all those words together. And it wasn't that I had never known how to read, it was just that at that time my mind wasn't functioning that well. But after I'd been sober a couple years, I was able to go start school, and I went at night while I worked full time, and things just sort of seemed to fall into place, and I kept doing that, and then I got offered a job on campus, and I switched, and kept moving along, and I finally got called in about 3 years later. Excuse me. And they told me that I had completed all of the requirements for the 2-year AA college degree. And I thought that was a nice name for a degree. I had never wanted a college degree when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, or even then I was just sort of taking the classes that they had, you know, sort of told me to take. But I called my sponsors up and my family and some of my foster parents at that time, and we went to this graduation ceremony because I'd never been to one. And I was walking up there, and they announced that I was graduating third in my class out of 485 students. And I thought that day, there wasn't a doubt in my mind how that was possible. Because when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I brought you a person who knew a little bit about surviving, but absolutely nothing about living. I brought you a person who couldn't read anymore and who couldn't remember which name was theirs. And somehow here it was just a couple years later, and I was able to do well in school. And I went ahead and I went on to school after that. I went on to the university, and I graduated from school a couple years after that. Somewhere along the line, I had come up with a dream that I'd had, and I can't honestly tell you whether I had it before I came to AA and forgot about it or what. But I learned about this dream that I had, and I had been taught to do the footwork for my dreams here in this program, and that's what I did. And I sent out a lot of applications, and I got a telegram, I guess about 5 years ago now, telling me that I had been chosen as one of 300 students out of 3,000 applicants to go to law school. And I'll tell you, when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, I had always planned on spending a lot of time in court. But never on that side of the table. And that's what I've been doing over the years since that time. I went ahead and I started law school, and I learned a lot in law school, and I don't just mean about the law. I learned, more importantly, a lot of things about Alcoholics Anonymous. I learned that I'd spent time in Alcoholics Anonymous growing up and learning a lack of judgment that we have for one another that doesn't really exist in a whole lot of other places. And I'd also developed a very strange sense of humor that seems only appropriate here a lot of the time. But it was... But when I got to this program, I didn't have a sense of humor. And I didn't think anything was funny, especially if it related to my life. Because my life was not funny. Nothing was funny. It was crying time, you know. And it took a long time and a couple of real hard sponsors with very warped senses of humor to help me develop the sense of humor that I have today, which is probably one of the greatest gifts I've been given here. But anyway, and I was in school and I was talking to these people. And, you know, a lot of these people, they didn't come from Venice when I was in school with them. And a lot of them, you know, we were talking, and I was talking to this one guy one time. We were talking about this movie, and it's the story of Janis Joplin, and it was called The Rose, and I don't know, but anyway, it was the story about Janis Joplin, and this guy says to me, he says, you know, I've always idolized Janis Joplin. And I said, really? It just sort of surprised me, because he was a very square guy. He was from behind the orange curtain down in Orange County, California, and he'd had a mother and a father, all that sort of stuff, very square. And I said, really? He says, yes, I just always thought that she was just one of the greatest. He said, but there's something about that movie that bothers me. And I said, well, what was that? And he says, well, in this movie, she meets this guy, and right before she has an affair with him, she tells him that she has a confession to make. She tells him that when she was in high school, she slept with the entire high school football team. And she wanted him to know that before they began this, you know, this affair and marriage. And he says to me, he said, you know, if that's true about Janis, I just don't think I could ever respect her again. And I looked at him and I said, you mean you'd hold one football team against a girl? And he didn't talk to me for 2 years after that. I never even went to high school, you know. Anyway. Law school was very hard for me. And there were an awful lot of times that I wanted to quit. I had... Since I'd walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd always had a lot of problems just being able to make my rent and get enough food, and there were a lot of times when I came outside in the morning, and there was a little grocery bag there with some peanut butter and bread, things like that, and I don't know who put that there today, but I know it was somebody in AA. And there were a lot of times in law school where I just thought, you know, I've just got to stop this. I've just got to get a job. You know, I was almost 10 years sober at that point, and I was still wondering where I was going to get my next peanut butter sandwich, you know. And I thought, I'm supposed to have my Mercedes by now. And all that sort of stuff. But I kept trying because my sponsors told me that AA had made it possible for me to get into law school, and that for someone like me, law school was an AA request. And that's the way that I did in law school. I showed up, I was on time, and I did what was asked of me to the best of my ability. But like I said, it just wasn't that easy a lot of the time. And anyway, turns out I was scheduled to graduate in May of 1983 from law school. And about 2 months before that time, I had a phone call telling me that my sponsor, Gail Wilson, was dying of cancer. And Gail was 48 years old. And I went over to the hospital, and I had known that she'd had cancer, but she had not wanted me to know that it was serious, and so she told me that it had been in remission or cured, even though she really had been real sick the whole time, and had never gone away. But anyway, and I went over, and we spent a lot of time in the room those last couple months. We did a lot of time talking, you know, and we talked about me and when I came into the program and the fact that I was going to graduate from law school, you know. While I was sitting there, nurses would come in. And she had a lot of staff helping her out there. And she introduced me to everybody that ever walked in that door. And these people had no interest whatsoever in meeting me. I can assure you they wanted to just do their job and get out of there, but she insisted on introducing me. And she would say to them, Nurse Smith, I want you to meet Junie. So Junie's like a daughter to me, and she's going to be an attorney. And I thought, you know, this is the same woman that used to say, don't sit next to me, and don't tell anyone that I am your sponsor. And now she wants to introduce me to strangers, you know. And as we sat there, we talked a lot about Alcoholics Anonymous, because there wasn't anything in the world that Gail Wilson loved more than that. And she told me, she said, you know, when I first met you, she said, I didn't think you were going anywhere. She said, with your attitude and your background, she said, I just didn't think you were going to go anywhere. And she said, I remember, you know, when you first told me that you were going to start a class in school, she said, I just wanted to shake my head and tell you not to bother. Because I knew someone like you couldn't do it. But I didn't. And she said, and then when you started telling me that someday you wanted to go to law school, she said, I had to force myself not to laugh. Because she said, I just knew someone like you couldn't do that. And as we sat there that day, we realized that, I realized, and Gail did too, that what had happened was, Gail hadn't said any of those things because Alcoholics Anonymous didn't give her the right. Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't give any of us the right to give up on people, even when we think that we should. I've sure seen a lot of people come in here and I've thought they've had one drink too many, you know. And then I've watched them. And it's worked for them, you know. And that was what had happened with Gail. She didn't believe in June. She didn't think June could do any of those things because June couldn't. But Alcoholics Anonymous could, and it has. And Gail did pass away. And I graduated about a month after that. And then I began to do what you have to do if you're going to practice as an attorney. And I know a lot of you might know this, but I didn't really know much about it. I began to study for the bar exam in California. And I studied for that the way that I had done everything else. You know, I gave it my all and studied every day, and I did what they told me to do. And I went to lots of meetings, and I tried to stay active in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I tried to keep a good spiritual foundation in my life. And I took the exam. And I, in December of 1983, received a telegram telling me that I did not pass that exam. And I absolutely could not believe it. I just couldn't believe it. I was in debt several thousand dollars at that point, and all the loans became due. The first, not all of them, portions of them began becoming due the 1st of December of that year. And I didn't have a job, and I couldn't get a job because I didn't pass that test. And it meant that I had to study for the test again and borrow more money. And I just didn't think it was what I was supposed to do. I just thought that that meant to me that I wasn't supposed to be an attorney and that I was supposed to go back and be a waitress like I'd worked my way through school. And my friends in Alcoholics Anonymous told me that, no, what it meant was I was supposed to take the test again. And that was one of the hardest periods of time in my life because I felt like I'd let everybody down that had helped me, and I felt like I'd let Gail down. And I just didn't understand if God was trying to give me a message and I wasn't getting it. But I said, all right, I'd give it one more chance. And I borrowed a bunch more money. I mean, what the hell? And I went ahead and I studied for the exam. And right when I was studying, when I didn't pass that exam, I was just really sad a lot of the time. And I went to meetings. So it was real hard for me to talk to people except for my closest friends. And I couldn't talk about it when I was asked to share in meetings because I would just fall apart too bad. And I was studying, and I got a phone call one day from central office, and they told me they had a 12-step call they wanted me to make. And I needed to study. But there isn't a doubt in my mind, or any of yours, I'm sure, that you know that that has to be put aside when central office calls. And I figured God had to know what he was doing, and so that's what I did. And I went over there, and my mom went with me on this 12-step call, and we went into this bar and picked up Lois. And we brought Lois home, and we were sitting there, and Lois and I were talking. Lois was crying. And she was saying, you know, Scott, I just don't think I'm going to be able to get a job. And I said, neither do I. And she said, you know, I just don't know how I'm going to pay my rent next month. And I said, neither do I. And she said, how long have you been sober? I said, 12 years. But Lois and I went to lots and lots of meetings. And I learned again a lesson that, fortunately for me, my higher power constantly puts in my life. That being that what it says in the big book is that when all else fails, try working with another alcoholic. Now, I have to tell you, during those occasions in my life, in my sobriety, when all else has failed, and there have been some of those occasions, I never think, I should work with another alcoholic. All I ever think is all else is failing. That's all I can think of. And fortunately for me, my higher power sent this person into my life and got me through that. Anyway, and I kept studying. I took the examination. And in June, a year ago, I received another telegram, and this one told me that I passed the examination. And I got to tell you, Having now received both telegrams, I was spiritually better equipped for the second telegram. And then they tell me in a telegram that that's still not all you have to do to be an attorney, naturally. You still have to be sworn in, which is just another way of getting a couple hundred dollars out of you. But they said in this telegram letter that swearing-in ceremony would be taking place on the 13th of July. And that was Gail Wilson's AA birthday. And so I thought then, and I think about it sometimes now, that that was probably the reason I didn't pass the first time, or at least maybe one of them. Maybe so I could pass on and be sworn in on the day that was Gail's birthday, because she'd had so much to do with my being where I was, and my sobriety, and my getting into law school. Anyway, I had told you a lot about, you know, the feelings that I had of suicide and stuff. And I don't want to be dishonest with anybody here and tell you that as soon as I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, that wasn't my answer anymore. It had been my answer for so long, and I was so unsure if Alcoholics Anonymous could work for someone like me, that I still kept that as my ace in the hole, that I'd just kill myself if this AA thing didn't work. When I had been sober for a couple of years, I started to date someone, and I got emotionally involved. And when I got emotionally involved, then I didn't need to pray anymore, because I sort of thought that you either needed a higher power or a boyfriend. I didn't see any reason to have both. So once I got a boyfriend, then I didn't need the higher power anymore. And then one day my boyfriend left. And I remember sitting there, and I had never experienced that. I had never in my life gotten that close to anyone so that they could walk out and hurt me like that. And it hurt a lot. And as I sat there on that bed that day, I thought, I'm going to kill myself. It's the only thing that'll work to get rid of this pain. And right then there was a knock on my door. And I went to the door, and there was this guy named Bob from AA. And he says, hey, how you doing? And I said, okay. And he said, listen, you remember you promised to go over to this high school? Central office had called and asked me to take you over there so we could talk to these kids a little bit about AA. And I said, gee, Bob, I don't really think you want to take me. I was just going to go in the bathroom and kill myself. And he said, well, have you had dinner? And I said, no. And he said, well, I'll tell you what. Let's go get some dinner. I'll take you to the high school. You don't have to say anything. I'll just talk for a little while, and then I'll bring you home, and you can kill yourself. And I said, okay. So we drove over to the school, and I didn't talk to Bob on the way over there. I didn't want to talk to Bob because when I'm feeling really bad, if you talk to somebody, then you get over it a little bit. So you have to really just have silence to really feel pain. And you have to just sort of think things through yourself. And as my sponsors have always told me, I haven't yet had a problem that's been as bad as my solution for it. But that was my solution. And as we drove over there, I thought about the fact that not only had this guy left me, but there would never be anyone else again. And you need silence to really feel that. And as we got to the school, we parked the car and we started to walk over to the classroom, and this girl came up to me, a complete stranger, and said, could you help me find room 203? And I thought, all right, I'll probably lose my place, but hopefully I can get back to it. So we wandered around the school, and I got her lost, and we started to talk, and she said, what kind of a class are you taking here tonight? And I said, well, I'm not really taking a class. And so what are you doing here? And I said, well, I came over with some friends, and we were going to sort of talk about a little bit about alcoholism. She goes, really, for it or against it? Well, I said, I guess you'd say against it. I've never heard of any talk for alcoholism. And she said, really, I'm on the wagon. And I said, well, that's wonderful. I've known a lot of people on the wagon. They usually fall off, but that's great for you. And she said, well, why would you be giving a talk like that? And I said, because I'm an alcoholic, and I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I stay sober one day at a time. Would you like to go to a meeting sometime? And she said, yes, she would. Now, obviously, I couldn't go home and kill myself. She'd think AA didn't work. And so what I did was I took Kay to lots and lots of meetings, and she had as much to do with my staying sober as I had to do with introducing her to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in August of this year, Kay will be celebrating 9 years of sobriety. One of the hardest things for certain for me in coming into this program was the way that I felt about myself, and I've already told you a little bit about that. But after that, not too long after that, those feelings of suicide started to go away. I just knew that it wasn't an answer. For me, it was really another way of not accepting God's will. You know, it was sort of like, do it my way, God, or I'll kill myself. And I had to realize that, you know, and I had to release that and try and start working this program in that area of my life. But what I kept doing was just what I was told to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. And one day, I was at this convention in Palm Springs, and it was a banquet, and everybody was all dressed up, and I had a long dress on too. And I was sitting there, and it was at night, and I was comparing myself to everybody else in the room, like I do so often still today. And I was looking around the room, all these beautiful dresses. And I thought, you know, I'm so sure glad I'm wearing this brown dress. And I thought, no, come on, look at that black one over there. Wouldn't you rather be wearing that? And I thought, no, I really like this brown one. I thought, well, what about the green one? Like, no, I want to wear this brown dress. I thought, really? I thought, yeah. I was just talking to myself. But I thought, you know, it's sort of fun having red curly hair. And I thought, come on. And I thought, no, really. I thought to myself, don't you even want to be blonde or stacked or anything? And I thought, no. For the first time in my entire life, I wanted to look like me. And that had never happened. Not even when I was 5 years old. I never wanted to look like me. And then I realized that right then and there, but right then, I wanted to feel like I was feeling right then. It just didn't hurt all the time anymore. It felt okay inside, you know, and I don't know how that happened. I don't know how Alcoholics Anonymous made that happen. I just know that it did, you know. And I don't want you to think I walk around every day since then feeling that way. There's some days I'd rather be blonde and stacked, you know. But there's an awful lot of the time where it's really okay to be me and to feel like me and to be walking around, you know, the person that I am. The relationship that I have with my mom took an awfully long time for us. My mom and I took our 1 year cakes together, and then my mom returned to drinking. And she came back to the program after a while. And even when she first got sober, it took a long time for me to get over blaming my mom for everything that had ever gone wrong in my life. And when I took my 10-year cake at my home group, Venice group, my mom came and gave me that cake. And that Monday night Venice group had been my mom's group. It was the first group I'd ever gone to when I was 6 years old. I went there with my mom. And I realized that night, when my mom was giving me my cake, that had it not been for my mom's alcoholism and all the hell that she went through and that I went through as a result of her drinking and her alcoholism, I might never have found Alcoholics Anonymous. And for the first time, I had to be able to start to forgive her for what had gone on and knowing that she never meant for it to be the way that it had been, you know. And that I was really, in a very strange and ironic sort of a sense, grateful for the life that I had had. Because maybe if any one of those things had ever changed, I wouldn't be where I am now. When I was watching the Olympics this year, I got a phone call from somebody in my law school class, and they told me about a woman in my class who had killed herself. And I'm a very emotional person. I'm sure you didn't notice that. And I was very emotional about the Olympics. I was very excited about them being in my town and everything. And when I hung up and I thought about the fact this woman wasn't a particularly close friend of mine. She was an acquaintance in my class. But when I realized that she killed herself, I sat there and I was watching the opening ceremonies of the Olympics, and I thought, she's going to miss all this. And she's going to miss so much more. And I thought, why would she do that? And for someone like me, someone who had been wanting to kill myself and trying to kill myself for all those years, to ever wonder why anyone would kill himself. It's one of the reasons that when I stood up here in the beginning, I told you that I am amazed what Alcoholics Anonymous has done in my life. There are days sometimes when I get up there and I think, hey, maybe you're not really an alcoholic. You were awfully young, 13 years old, probably just a wild kid sowing her oats. And then I think back on my favorite part in the Big Book, chapter 3, which I always go to and read whenever I think that I'm maybe not an alcoholic anymore, where it talks about the great obsession of every abnormal drinker is that someday they could control and enjoy their drinking. And when I think back upon are the people that I grew up with in Venice, in my gang, and some of the other people. And I got to tell you that as I stand here today, there isn't one woman that I grew up with that's not dead in an institution or out there on the street today turning tricks so that she can support her habits. And that's where I'm supposed to be. That's where people who grow up in Venice the way that I grew up end up. That's where dirty little Venice broads go. And I'm not there today. And I don't honestly believe that I am a chosen person. I don't honestly believe that my higher power loves me any more than he loves any one of those women that I was out there growing up with. I believe there's only one difference between me and them. I found Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you.